Hello and welcome to Talking Europe. My guest today is the President of Finland, Alexander Stubb. He is in Paris attending a conference that was called by the French president with what is being called the Coalition of the Willing and Able to continue to provide support to Ukraine. It's one of a number of diplomatic initiatives around Ukraine that are happening at the moment. Alexander Stubb has had a very distinguished political career in Finland. He has been a prime minister, foreign minister, finance minister, minister of European Affairs and Foreign Trade, and also chairman of the National Coalition Party, which is a liberal conservative party in Finland. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So this coalition of the willing and able, the French are calling it sort of essentially a Franco-British creature. What role do you see then for other countries and Finland, for example, in this coalition?
To support and engage. So the starting point is that this is originally a Franco-British initiative, which I welcome. It's a way to bring Britain back into Europe and get France engaged with Britain in a constructive way again. I think our mindset is very clear. We want Ukraine to win this war. We want them to retain their independence, sovereignty and territorial integrity. And the French and the Brits took the lead, and the rest of us are following and being engaged as we best can. There's so many ways in which we can help.
And so the French and the Brits are talking about reassurance forces in Ukraine, not combat forces. Is that a contradiction in terms? Can they be reassuring if they're not combat, if they don't have weapons?
No, it's not a contradiction in terms. And I think a lot of people are getting their terms and timing messed up here. So we need to look at this in two phases. The first phase is a ceasefire. The second phase is actual peace agreement. So for the ceasefire, you need some kind of a reassurance. That means that you can help in the air, on the sea, perhaps in the land. That's the type of planning that our military staff are doing right now and the political decisions that we take here in Paris. The second one then is when peace has been maintained, settled and agreed. That's when you put in crisis management troops or peacekeeping troops on the basis of an international mandate. So they're two quite separate things. The ceasefire is still a state of war, whereas a peace agreement, that's when peace begins. So we'll have to look how we can best help. Reality, however, is that Ukraine has the biggest and most modern and the most ferocious army in Europe right now with 800,000 men and women.
But although it's had huge losses as well in this war of attrition, so it does need a diplomatic solution.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. We need to find peace. That's not a question, and that's what we're trying to do. Yeah. And we want to show that there's strong European support for the Ukrainians.
And you've been a bit skeptical about the ceasefire, the state of play on the ceasefire, saying that the initiatives in the Black Sea, for example, or the moratorium on attacks on energy infrastructure, that doesn't go far enough, it's not enough.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, what we're seeing is a classic Russian negotiating tactic. So Ukraine wants a full ceasefire, Europe wants a full ceasefire, America wants a full ceasefire, and Russia forces it into a partial ceasefire, which in the first phase was energy infrastructure, which of course the Russians bombed immediately after they had agreed on a ceasefire. And the second phase is now a ceasefire in the Black Sea. These are all steps in the right direction, but never underestimate the capacity of Russians to break a ceasefire. They'll continue to do it. We need a full ceasefire, and that needs to be monitored.
So everything that this coalition of the willing is doing, whatever it ends up deciding, do you think there will be an American backstop?
Well, I hope so. It's always difficult to talk about the terminology, but I see it sort of with three pillars. The crux of the security arrangements and the reassurance will, of course, be brought by Ukrainian troops. Then the key engagement comes from European troops. And then there has to be some kind of an agreement that, you know, if things turn out really bad, America will be engaged. And of course, it's not so much about using American troops, but using American material, using American reconnaissance, using American intelligence, et cetera, et cetera.
Would you think that sort of American support will continue given how difficult this relationship is now between the EU and the US? We saw those very disdainful comments by the Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth about hating European freeloading. And we've now just had Donald Trump announcing tariffs on cars, which is going to hit the European car industry, particularly the German car industry.
Well, I think, you know, in foreign policy, it's always good to recognize the realities. And there's a change in tack in the transatlantic relationship. But then you always have to ask your question, okay, if that's the case, what do you do? I think we have to prove ourselves. So we do two things. One, we increase our own defense expenditure, we take care more of our own security. And then secondly, we take more responsibility for helping out Ukraine. When it comes to freeloading, I have to say that coming from a country with 1,340 kilometers of border with Russia, which has obligatory military service and one of the biggest militaries in Europe, and that has always bought American military equipment, including 62 F-18s and 64 F-35s, and having the biggest artillery in Europe together with Poland. Up there in the northern flank, we don't freeload. We help. We are security providers, not security consumers.
And actually, a great majority of NATO members are not freeloading. According to the NATO figures, 23 out of 32 countries last year met or exceeded their defense spending targets. Those, of course, were agreed with the Americans at the time. Yeah. And yet we still have this kind of rhetoric about freeloading.
Well, yeah, I mean, the rhetoric is a little bit tough, but let's give a little bit of credit to the Americans as well and to President Trump. I think he has done more in 5 weeks in pushing Europe to take care of its own security than previous American presidents in 50 years. So, you know, there's an element that we are actually reacting to what the Americans are saying, and that's actually a good thing. So put the rhetoric aside and see what's happening on the ground.
And on that specific point, I was going to ask you about ReArm EU, this $800 billion European plan. Of course, there are national capitals that are worried about their debts already, and they don't want to get even more into debt. Do you think that's a reasonable position?
I think it's a reasonable position, but what Europe is trying to do is now to find creative ways to hike up defense expenditure. And then there are many ways you can do it. One is, of course, you use your own money, and that's going to, you know, go to deficits, but a lot of them are going to have to do that. The second one is to use different types of financial instruments, like the European Investment Bank, which I think should be also not investing, but lending in the sphere of defense. And the third one is, of course, then the mutualization of debt when it comes to defense expenditure or purchases. And the last one is, which the European Commission has been dealing with, is perhaps easing the financial constraints that we have. And I think all of those instruments put together will give us a little bit of a boost.
And of course, we do still have countries that are worried about this common debt idea. They think that it's going to increase the burden. There seems to be some confusion, though, about common debt. Maybe you can clarify that a bit.
I don't know if I'm good at clarifying it, because it's my prime minister that does the EU and I do NATO. But I think the basic idea is that right now we are in a crisis situation. So then we have to ask ourselves the question, can we give a little bit of leeway and flexibility when it comes to defense expenditure, when it comes to defense investment? And the idea is also that you can actually leverage more money into the system if you do it together and therefore mutualize debt, a little bit like was done during COVID.
On the big defense reforms, though, if we look at the big picture going forward, you've got this unanimity rule on defense decisions. And that, of course, raises the question of Hungarian opposition to any major changes. How do you think the EU should approach that?
I don't think it's going to be a problem. Never underestimate the capacity of astute lawyers in Brussels to find solutions in these kinds of things. Constructive abstention is an instrument that can already be used in the treaties. I'm a sad case. I wrote my PhD at the LSE on flexible integration. In other words, the possibility for some member states to do one thing and others to do another thing. So I'm sure we have enough instruments to be used.
Ukraine, there were a couple of things I wanted to add. This plan for emergency military aid that Kaja Kallas had proposed, that doesn't really seem to have gone very far. Do you think there's any alternative to that, or how would you kind of take that idea forward, given the existing constraints?
Well, I mean, Europe is never perfect, and the instruments that are used are never perfect. There's always some kind of a compromise. I'm quite confident that at some stage, some kind of a plan linked to what Kaja Kallas put forward earlier will materialize. It just, I guess, wasn't ripe yet in the past European Council. We all understand that we need to continue financial, military, and political support.
Yeah, because there was not even a specific figure given to this aid. And on the issue of a possible special envoy being appointed to Ukraine, is that a good idea, or would it just duplicate the existing positions in the EU?
No, I think it would be a good idea, and it should be what I call a EU plus minus, which we're seeing here in Paris with a coalition of the willing. So what we need, two things. One is a negotiating team, just like the Americans, the Ukrainians, and the Russians have, and they had that in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. And then probably eventually we need a special envoy who would be kind of in charge and coordinating everything. Because right now, albeit we have really good leadership coming from France and the UK, there is still that question, okay, who is the European envoy? Who should I call?
Mm. You're in Paris, of course, for this conference, as I said at the outset, and the French are very much pushing the idea of European preference in defense investments. As someone from a Nordic country, are you perhaps less doctrinaire on that question? As long as the weapon system works, you're fine with that. It doesn't have to be a European label.
Yes, certainly. I don't think it's a binary issue. I think we sort of need to pool our defense industries a little bit. We have to remember that right now, Europe buys double the amount of stuff than the US does from itself. So we actually support a lot of the American defense industry. At the same time, we have to understand that we have to continue promoting and investing in our own defense industry. And a good starting point, of course, would be that we put the orders in together and not separately.
On a final point, which is really a very different thing, but Finland has just been voted the happiest country in the world for the eighth time running. And you yourself say Finns are people that don't necessarily smile very much. So what is the relationship between that and happiness then?
Well, I mean, there's a famous Finnish poet called Eino Leino. And he once wrote a poem, said that from happiness at the end of the day comes sadness. So that's very much sort of the mentality that we have. I think it's all based on a functioning welfare society. We love nature. We do education. We're quite cool, calm, and collected. You know, we don't make a lot of noise. So I think inside we smile, outside we don't always show it.
We'll stop there. Thank you so much for your insights, President Alexander Stubb of Finland. Thanks for watching us here on Talking Europe.